Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today, it's gardening with horticulturist and entomologist Roberta Clark. Good morning, Roberta.
Good morning, Mindy.
So before we get to the gardening, let's talk about cicadas for a minute because it's like I am so disappointed I don't have any in my yard. And some folks who have, they're like, you can have mine. I'm like, yes, I would love to have them. But we were seeing hot spots, and I think you have some in your yard, right?
Oh, I have a lot in my yard. I'm fascinated by it. It's very funny because the previous emergence, I believe 2008, I didn't have a lot here. But this year, I was starting to think I wasn't going to have them. I could hear them two blocks over in the undeveloped area. There's a bog in there. And they were quite loud. And I could see all the holes in my ground. And then starting a few weeks ago, they all started coming out in my yard. I even had a big emergence just in the past couple of days. So yeah. They are emerging in waves. A lot of it depends on soil temperature, and I now have them flying through my yard, and I hear the chorus, which can be quite deafening at times. I enjoy this phenomena just because it's something that only happens once every 17 years.
Right? I know. It's fun. I saw a couple holes in my yard, but I haven't seen any. My grandson came home from school yesterday, and he's been keeping an eye out. He went in the backyard, and he was so disappointed. And luckily, Dan had mentioned that he had been at Soar's Garden, and he said it was deafening. So I said, come on, let's get in the car. Went to Soar's Garden, and let me tell you, that is a hot spot. They are flying all over the place. He was very excited. So he got to, you know, pick up some of the little, you know, skeletons, whatever, and put them in a little bag. And he was very happy. And I got to get some more plants. So it was a win-win for everybody. But
there you go.
You can, even if you're driving down 28 through Mashpee, any of those like wooded spots, roll down your window, you can hear that they're so loud and they're flying around there. So they're really interesting to see, for sure.
They are. And, you know, some people are concerned. They don't bite. They don't sting. They cause no real harm to the environment. And while some people find them an annoyance, they're an amazing resource for wildlife. This is like a banquet every 17 years. Very high protein snacks for birds, for mammals, for all sorts of different critters. So we should celebrate the cicadas.
Yes, we should. And then not to mention those little skeletons, they're good fertilizer, right?
They're very cool.
Yeah, love the red eyes. Yeah, they're very cool.
Yes.
All right, so we've had a little bit of rain for a long time on the weekends. I don't even know how many weeks was it, 17 or something crazy.
It's very long.
Very long.
Very depressing.
Yeah. But I'm wondering, does that mean we're still in a drought situation?
I haven't looked at the latest drought monitor. It has changed over the past few weeks, where the entire Cape was in moderate drought. The last time I looked, which I think was 2 weeks ago, the Upper Cape had now come out of the moderate drought and was just considered dry. Mm-hmm. Mid-Cape to Orleans was still considered moderate drought. Mm-hmm. I suspect that's changed. I know we've had a couple of rainfalls here at my house where I've recorded well over an inch of rain.
Mm-hmm, me too, yeah.
So I don't think we're really facing drought conditions yet, which is not to say it won't happen in July or August.
Right.
What concerns me more is we've had days on end of just drizzle.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't really penetrate the ground deeply, but it keeps foliage wet. And I'm starting to see people coming into the garden center with a handful of leaves of various different plants, hydrangeas, tomatoes, et cetera, with leaf spots on them.
Right.
So anytime we have moisture constantly on foliage of different plants, that's a prime opportunity for fungal organisms to germinate and penetrate foliage and cause leaf spotting diseases.
Right. And so with this sort of moist weather on the weekends, which is when most of us can get out in the garden, way behind on chores. Like usually way before the beginning of June, I have a garden path and I've freshed it with some pine needles. Still, I haven't done that. I haven't done a lot of weeding. I'm like, oh my gosh, it's like, we're a couple of weeks, we're going to be into July, and I'm still not ready.
Well, I always optimistically set 4th of July as my date to be pretty much everything planted. I don't know that I'm going to make that this year. Just yesterday, I finally started potting up all the many annuals that I planted into my ornamental containers. It's 17th of June, and I'm just now potting up my geraniums. But, you know, it's never too late. Yeah. We have a beautiful long fall, so perhaps our springs aren't as conducive to gardening as we would like. We do have the rest of the summer well into October as wonderful gardening time.
On the flip side, it's been a nice spring for my pansies and violas. I just yesterday took some out of some containers because I just didn't have the heart while they were looking so fabulous, and now they're starting to get a little leggy. I went, okay, now I can put in the summer plants. But So at least we had, you know, the violas and pansies that were fabulous for the spring.
And lettuce, oh my goodness, lettuce has been an abundant crop this year. Anything that liked the cool weather, that people actually got out, we had it's like from mid-April to mid-May, maybe late May, it was actually pretty nice.
Yeah.
A lot of sun, fairly warm. I got most of my vegetable garden in. I even, the day after Mother's Day, and I knew I was taking a chance, I put in tomatoes, peppers, and cucumbers, and then we had that terrible nor'easter and temperatures in the low 50s for days on end. Everything came through it very well, except my cucumbers. They did not like that. And they're a little stunted, but I've seen them starting to grow now. But anything else that really enjoyed a cooler period of time has been going gangbusters. Yeah. Lettuce, bok choy, spinach, kale, peas, have all done beautifully so far this spring.
Not for me. I have zero peas, and my lettuce is just starting to come back, and that's not because of the weather. It's because of the rabbits.
Oh, yes.
Those rabbits are everywhere.
You have to fence your garden.
Yeah, it's crazy. All right, let's talk
really
to...
really do.
Yeah, Tor Hansen's on the line giving us a call. Hi, Tor.
Oh, good morning, Mindy. I don't know who you're conversing with, but I wanted to share some thoughts on cicadas.
Sure.
I heard a remark saying they don't bite, but contrary to that, when I picked up one, I was at Crane just before we spoke last week about cicadas, and they're going strong there, and they're mating very quickly. But one time, some years ago, I think I was also at Crane, and I picked up one. And whammo, I got zapped by that beak that they have, the kind that they use for when they want to insert and get into the foliage or the stems of plants. And it hurt. And
wow.
So I quickly tossed the cicada away. So I wanted to share that with you. And then also, I just want to stress how wonderful it is if you can be there when they emerge from the ground. Mm. I've had no luck there at Crane yet because I'm not there at the earliest daylight hour, which is my question. Do you have any info about when in the daylight calendar is the best hour to actually witness them coming out of the ground, climbing onto the stem, and then opening from the nymph shell?
Good question.
Expansion of the wings. It's a wonderful thing.
Yeah. Do you know, Roberta?
They generally emerge overnight. They don't emerge generally during the daytime hours. It's usually at night. So a little more difficult to actually see it in process. Mm-hmm. And just to comment on what he said, cicadas do not have mouth parts that can bite. They do have modified mouth parts. They're called piercing sucking. And I guess it is possible for, on occasion, one to pierce your skin, but it's highly unusual.
Yeah, I was going to say, kind of a freak thing that happened there.
Yes.
Yeah, and so that emerging at night would explain why maybe they're so loud in the morning.
They're very loud in the morning. I start hearing them around 6:30 when the sun comes up, although it didn't come up today, and I'm still hearing them. They're really quite loud all morning and well into the afternoon, and then it's still present, but it dies off somewhat in the late afternoon and early evening.
Yeah, it was late afternoon yesterday when we took our trip to Soares, and one of the gals there was saying, oh, you should have heard it this morning. It was deafening.
Yeah. Yeah, 10 to noon is like peak cicada singing time, it seems.
That's good. Yeah, Tor, thanks for the phone call. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. So back to the rabbits for a minute here. I am so perplexed because, you know, for years you've heard me say, the rabbits just eat the clover. They don't jump up into my you know, raised beds. Well, not only do they jump up into my raised beds, I caught one up in one of my containers that's like 3 feet off the ground.
Well, I've often said rabbits are broad jumpers, not high jumpers, but I have to tell you, I have raised beds. They're about 8 inches tall, and on top of that, I have about 24 inches of plastic fencing. And I was out, I got home from work, and as I usually do, I went out to see what's going on in the garden, and here's a bunny absolutely inside the plastic fencing. And I scolded it, and it leaped and did a high jump and jumped right out.
Wow.
And so I'm thinking, well, I'm hoping that's just a freak occurrence.
Yeah, right. Well, same thing when I chased, I went running out to my container and it, you know, hopped away and, you know, took off. But
I
am noticing that they are very alert when I open that slider because they're expecting the dog.
yes. What cracks me up is every year I overseed my front lawn with clover and other fine fescues and drought tolerant grasses. And the rabbits do love it, and they come in and they feed on the clover. Unfortunately, the clover isn't out early enough to save my hostas, but now they're eating clover, and when I let the dog out, they freeze.
Yeah.
And he doesn't see them.
Right.
He's 16. That could have something to do with it. If they move, he's right on them, but as long as they stay still, the dog doesn't get them.
Yeah. So I have a lot of clover in my front yard, too. And I think they get the clover in the front yard, and then they come under the fence for maybe dessert in my backyard.
Yeah. But what I've used this year, not on my vegetables, but on annuals that I put out, is the liquid plant skid. And it's doing a wonderful job protecting my zinnias and snapdragons and other annuals that I've planted from the rabbits. Unfortunately, it doesn't protect from earwigs, which got my zinnias. So now I've got some diatomaceous earth, and I'm going to replant zinnias, and they'll get plant skid, and when it's dry, they'll get sprinkled with the diatomaceous earth.
Yeah, always something, right?
We have to. Yes, it is.
Always something after our gardens. 866-999-4626 is our number for your garden questions or tips. We love tips, too. 866-999-4626, our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll have more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking gardening this morning with Roberta Clark. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, let's talk about the vegetable garden for a moment. Besides rabbits, earwigs, and the weather, what are we seeing happening? Are we seeing early blight on the tomatoes?
I haven't seen early blight yet, but I expect it to be present fairly soon because of all the wet foliage. And on my list of things to do sooner rather than later is to treat my tomatoes with Revitalize, which is a biofungicide that's been on the market for a couple of years. It's getting really good reviews. It triggers an immune response in the plants that it doesn't control 100% of the disease, but it certainly reduces the amount of foliar disease your tomatoes might have. So that's going to go on, hopefully, maybe Thursday, my next day off. The other thing I always like to do with my tomatoes, particularly the indeterminate varieties, and this is something particularly newer gardeners don't always do, is I make sure that as the tomatoes begin to get some height on them, I'm removing the bottom leaves just one set at a time. So eventually I have 12 to 18 inches of bare stem at the bottom of the plant. And what this does, it allows good air circulation, which helps to reduce potential disease problems. The other thing I do, again, on indeterminate varieties, is I try to be very faithful about going out and removing the suckers, which are basically little bitty stems that form where the leaves attach to the main stem. You really should try to keep your indeterminate tomatoes to one main stem. And again, this is to allow good air circulation to reduce the potential for foliar disease.
I could see some people going, indeterminate, determinate, what does that mean? What's the difference?
Okay, yeah. I think the easiest way to explain it is a determinate tomato grows to a determined height and sets a predetermined amount of tomatoes. And then that's it for the year. So if you're pruning all the suckers, I like to prune some on determinate, but if you're pruning all the suckers on a determinate tomato, these are usually the bush tomatoes, mm-hmm. the patio tomatoes. There are a couple of others. Defiant, I think, is one that's determinate. If you're pruning the suckers, it limits the amount of crop you get. So on a determinate tomato, you don't do a lot of pruning. Right. Indeterminate means it just keeps growing. It becomes a tall vine. Some years my tomato plants can get to be 6, 7, 8 feet tall. And if you allow it to produce all those suckers, it turns into a jungle.
Yeah.
And I don't think the quality of the fruit you get is as good as it might be. So that's the basic difference between determinate and indeterminate tomato. One is short and the other is a vine.
Got it. All right. Nancy is calling from Centerville. Hi, Nancy.
Hey, how are you this morning?
Great.
I had a question for you about rhododendrons. My neighbor and I bought a couple of them last fall, put them in, and they did really well. And now one of them, which is called a pink rose bay, it has flowers, but it also has shoots that are, of green leaves that are like 12 to 18 inches tall. And it looks like it's going to be a really leggy plant. Should we let it go like that, or should we cut those back?
The rose bay rhododendron is one of the what we call the ironclad rhododendrons. They were, before all the plant breeders got into the act with rhododendrons, they were basically Roseum elegans and Nova Zembla, and there were maybe 4 or 5 different varieties of rhododendrons. And that's all that was basically available a long time ago. But they are called ironclad because they're really tough, but they are big. They're not small rhododendrons, and it's hard to control their size per se. It possibly, how much sunlight is it getting, or is it in dappled shade or dense shade?
It gets pretty good sunlight. It's there's some trees around it, but they're pretty much in, you know, 6 or 8 hours of sunlight a day,
yeah,
in the middle of the day.
Then I would say that tall growth pattern is probably normal for that particular type of rhododendron. You could try to shorten them, but it's generally it's hard to control the size of a plant through pruning. I might just let them go and enjoy it.
Okay, great. Thank you. Good advice. Thanks so much for the call.
Sure. Yeah. All right. Thank you. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Last month, we were talking about basil, and you mentioned the Rutgers Obsession, and I found some.
Oh, excellent.
Yes.
Excellent.
So I planted that along with the other one I have, and we'll see what happens. But I guess it's good to have a little bit of variety, right? And then see which ones do better.
Which ones survive.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes, I planted, I found a 6-pack of Rutgers Obsession at Jenny's Edibles and Blooms.
Mm.
Great locally grown plants, highly recommend it. And I also planted what the heck is the name of it? It's another downy mildew-resistant basil. And I like to see the comparison between the two. So far, the Rutgers is taller and a little more vigorous than the other one.
Yeah, me too. Yeah.
So I'm quite happy with it.
Yeah, we'll see how that goes. All right.
I see pesto in my future.
I know, right? And I throw it in the freezer.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then that way, you know, those little vacuum sealed things, I have one of those little things that you can vacuum.
They come in very handy.
Yeah, they sure do. Chris in Marston's Mills says, thoughts on keeping turkeys from eating hostas and other perennials?
Unfortunately, I don't think I have a solution to turkeys.
Yeah.
And Marston's Mills, I live in the area. We have a number of fairly large flocks. There's one further down towards Sandwich on Newtown Road that literally stops traffic when it crosses the road. There are so many turkeys in the group. You know, you could try sort of motion type wind jammer type things that might startle them and keep them from coming in. I had a friend who had a flock of turkeys, and they liked to roost in the vegetable garden.
Oh, my goodness.
There was really not a lot that this person could do about it. I don't know of any repellents for birds.
Yeah, sorry about that, Chris.
you could try coyote urine, which is available at garden centers and hardware stores, and perhaps the fragrance of the coyote urine will keep the turkeys away. It could keep you away, too.
Yeah.
I know it is somewhat effective as a deer repellent, so it might be worth the try.
All right, thanks for that. Alan is calling from Vineyard Haven. Hi, Alan.
Hello, how are you today?
Great.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is this. In 1971, the previous owners of my house planted a wisteria plant.
Oh, dear.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they put up three sections of stockade fence, and it promptly ate the fence. And yeah. I have a root where it was planted about 9 or 10 inches in diameter, and it's everywhere in my yard.
Yep.
Yeah. What's the best way to get rid of it?
That is basically mechanical removal. It's when it's that extensive. You could also cut that very, very, very large trunk and treat it with a brush or stump killer. It's a chemical. I don't know of anything organic that will do it, but brush killer will. It contains a material called triclopyr, and you would read the label directions and follow them and apply it to the cut surface. And it just might be very laborious, but that might be the best way to do it.
Alan, I have the same problem in my yard, and I've lived in this house for a long time, and I just keep you just got to keep digging at it, and I keep going, how could this thing keep coming back? But yeah, it's a tough one.
That's how I feel about bittersweet.
Yeah.
I have a little of that, too.
Oh, boy. Oh, keep you busy, that's for sure. Alan, good luck. Thanks for the call.
Yeah.
Tom is calling from Chatham. Hi, Tom.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for your wonderful program. We have four large, very large beech plums in our property that we planted about 40 to 45 years ago. And they produce off and on through the years. 2 years ago in 2023, there was a huge bumper crop of beech plums, really spectacular. Last year, not so many. We figured they were taking a kind of a year off. This year, we had huge amount of blossoms and blooms, looked like good, lots of bee activity. So we felt that they were pollinated beautifully, but there are very few leaves on trees now. There's only one spot on one bush that has what I consider regular foliage. Do you have any thoughts about that?
It has to be related to the weather, I would think. Beach plums are notorious for not producing regularly, but it sounds like you're having some issue with the foliage. Do you see any spots or dieback, or are they simply bare branches?
It's just bare branches or very few leaves on a branch. And we've had that before, but this is extreme.
Yeah.
And we have read something that's only lasting 30 to 40 years, but I didn't think that was a thing. But there's serious thoughts on that.
Yeah. Have you checked to see if the wood is still alive, or are these actually dead limbs?
Wood is still good. Last year I did prune off a lot of small branches that had no leaves on them throughout the whole season, and hope that would help with everything. This year, there's so dramatic, the loss of foliage.
That's very interesting. Now, I'm assuming they're receiving full sun.
Yes, they're in a great place. Get full sun all day long.
Yeah. Oh, it's a mystery to me. Have you fertilized them? Even though most of the time we don't generally fertilize beech plums, it's a possibility they might benefit from a light fertilization.
Okay, that's something we will try then. No, we've never done that.
Yeah. I use something like plant tone or holly tone, and you may not see a response this year, but you may see a response next year.
Right. Yeah. Tom, good luck with that. Thank you for the call. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. You know, I don't always fertilize my, you know, but this year I did put the holly tone on the azaleas and the rhodies and my holly trees. And boy, what a difference. Boy, my azaleas were just packed with flower blooms this year.
Yeah. Yeah.
Unbelievable.
I'm not a huge fertilizer person.
Me either.
Mainly because I'm a lazy gardener. but I did fertilize this year, particularly in my front yard, which is, you know, my yard was, when I bought the house in 94, there was nothing planted here. There were a couple of old red cedars and a couple of pitch pines, but basically my yard was full sun, front and back. And I've planted so many darn trees and shrubs that I now have deep shade, and I've lost all my sun-loving plants. But I've noticed I didn't fertilize for several years, and I noticed things were looking like they could use a little bit of a boost. So I did fertilize this spring, and things have responded quite nicely. Yeah. So, you know, if things aren't growing quite as well as you would like, it is a good idea every few years. You don't think you need to fertilize your trees every year, but it is a good idea every few years to get out there and put out some plant tone or holly tone, and your plants will thank you.
Yeah. All right. Harry writes, greetings from Alexandria, Virginia, where our peonies and Japanese irises bloom beautifully this spring. Last fall, I planted asters gifted from a friend in a border that is watered by in-ground sprinklers and probably too thickly planted. The asters were growing robustly all spring, but I noticed last weekend that the foliage at the bottom of the plant is quickly turning brown. Vibrant green on top, but dying down below. Same thing happened at the far side, 12 inches away in the same garden with my own asters last fall. Is this normal for asters, or is there some disease at work? They are lovely blue flowers at the end of the season, and I'd hate to lose them.
Yeah, I find that asters, particularly the tall growing varieties, of which most asters are, generally, particularly if they're crowded, they do lose the foliage on the lower part of the stems. So that's just how they grow, and they don't always look that great because of that. So sometimes earlier in the season, you can cut them back and make them a little bushier. That might help, or thin them out so they get better air circulation and sunlight can penetrate all the way through.
Yeah.
That's the way asters grow.
Yeah, I cut my asters back until about 4th of July, and then I leave them be. The other thing, too, is I put them behind other flowers so that you don't see all that brown on the bottom. So that's another little trick you can try.
Yes, that's a great trick. The same thing for people love to grow the alliums, which are really kind of incredible spring blooming members of the onion family, but their foliage, and this is normal, turns yellow and starts to look really ugly just when the flowers shoot up to bloom. So you almost always want to plant something in front of them to hide that.
Yeah, exactly. It's so funny because I have most of my daffodils planted in the hosta beds so that as they start to die back, the hosta leaves cover the leaves. So
that yellowing foliage, exactly. Which is going on right now. I actually braided mine last week.
I did that last year. I didn't have, again, being behind, I didn't do that this year, and now it's kind of a little too late. I have a couple of just absolutely gorgeous hostas. They're huge, and I mean really large. They were under a tree that I removed, and now I'm like looking at them going, oh, once this summer sun starts beating on them, they're going to be in big trouble. So I'm gonna have to move those in the fall. But again, I'm like, where am I going to put them? I don't have a lot of room.
Well, I have run into that problem for some time now, and I keep telling myself I cannot buy any more perennials. Mm-hmm. And then I find I now have the driveway collection of perennials right. going, and they need to get in the ground relatively soon.
Yeah.
We'll see. Maybe by the 4th of July.
Right, exactly. Before I move on from the vegetable garden, one other thing, I planted my parsley. I did some. I bought a couple of plants, but I also put seeds. Forget it. Those rabbits are not letting that parsley grow. And my parsley is now just a couple of sticks sticking up. So I'm gonna have to redo that. But nobody ever touches my sage. I have the most beautiful sage. It's been there for years, and I am always
bloomed beautifully this year.
Oh, so pretty. And I'm like, okay, there's one thing I think we can not have to worry about the rabbits eating.
Here's a trick that I learned for protecting individual smaller plants like parsley. Sometimes if you go to the dollar store, you can find them, or you can order them on Amazon. They're like wire mesh small waste paper baskets.
Mm.
And you simply turn them over the plant, and the rabbits can't get to it. You're not having to. I love plant skid. It's a wonderful rabbit repellent, but you don't want to use it on the vegetable.
Right. Anything you're going to eat, right?
Yeah. It's a pig blood byproduct is what it's made from, and it's a red color, and it just is not wonderful to. I don't want to eat it, so I don't put it on my vegetables. But it worked really well on my zinnias this year.
So that's a good tip.
Try the wire mesh small trash cans, and you can buy them by the 5-pack or 10-pack on Amazon, and they work great.
Yeah, I bought another parsley plant that I'm about to put out, so I'll give that a try. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll have more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. It's Gardening This Morning with horticulturist and entomologist Roberta Clark. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We have Mary giving us a call. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I'm calling from the vineyard.
Hi.
I have a tomato problem, or rather, I had one last year. At the end of the season last year, my tomatoes all got some kind of a disease and just sort of collapsed. Mm. And I love to grow tomatoes, and I'm worried this year about replanting tomatoes because I was told, or I read somewhere, that you shouldn't plant tomatoes in the same places every year.
That's right.
Especially not if you've had diseases.
Yep.
So what should I do if I want to grow tomatoes this year?
Well, that I wrote, even though I only have I have 7 raised beds, and I rotate my tomatoes, so I don't grow them in the same bed every year. I try not to grow them in the same bed any sooner than every third year, and that way you tend to avoid a buildup of organisms that can cause disease. In particular, the concerning ones for tomatoes, besides the early blight, are verticillium wilt or fusarium wilt, which are soil-borne organisms. So if you have verticillium in your soil and you continue to plant susceptible tomatoes there, they will get verticillium. The alternate way to approach this is if you can't rotate your tomatoes, make sure that the ones you are growing are disease-resistant varieties, and you would look on the label or the description and it would say VF on it. That stands for verticillium and fusarium resistant. Or you could try growing them in big containers.
Yeah.
Well, I do have them in, I had them in containers, and two big containers, and I, of course, went wild planting tomatoes, so I had tomatoes in both containers last year. And
how many tomatoes in a container?
Three in each of two containers.
And how big were the containers?
Quite large. Let's see. I'm looking at them right now. 4 feet by 5 feet, something like that.
That's a good
okay,
size.
That's a good size. I was envisioning a large pot with three tomatoes in it.
I wouldn't do that.
It's did you prune them and allow for good air circulation?
I think there was a real problem with air circulation last year. I really do. They're in one of the containers in particular is kind of under some trees. The other one is more open. But they both got this disease, whatever it was.
Yeah.
Well, then I would do this year, make sure you're pruning out the suckers and prune off the lower leaves and do everything you can to improve air circulation. When you water, water the soil, not the foliage. A good deep soaking once or twice a week is adequate. You don't want to be spraying them every day. And you might start now using a product like Revitalize or another biofungicide and apply it according to the label directions. Most fungicides, whether they're the actual old-fashioned fungicides or the new, more modern biofungicides, are preventative in nature. They're not curative. So by starting now before you have a problem and applying it on a regular basis according to the label directions, you can prevent disease.
Right. All right, Mary, good luck with those tomatoes.
Yeah, that's very helpful. I was thinking I might just give up on tomatoes this
year. No, don't give up.
Don't give up. Okay.
Tomatoes are too good to give up on. Mary, good luck. Let's talk to Richard, who's giving us a call from Mashpee. Hi, Richard.
Hey, hi there.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Okay. I have some fava beans that I recently planted, and they came up great. They're looking wonderful. I was away for 4 days, and when I came back this morning, they're covered with a black coating on some of their leaves and stems. And, you know, it looks like some sort of virus or fungus, but I couldn't identify it. Not sure if you're familiar with that. The rest of the beans in the same area look wonderful.
Huh. Is it sort of just a general discoloration or distinct spots? What could you describe it maybe a little bit more?
No, there's sections of the stems that are black, and then sections of some of the leaves that are quite black and crinkled also. Kind of, you know, it looks like they may have gotten, had I been spraying anything, I would think maybe that would have done it, but I don't spray anything on them.
Yeah.
So it's just I don't know if there's a typical fava bean fungus that is known.
Not that I'm aware of, but I don't specifically grow fava beans. I just grow your regular bush beans, but they're all in the same family and have similar problems. My suggestion is to call the Master Gardener hotline at the Cape Cod Cooperative Extension, and perhaps they can do some looking up in books and get some information for you on that. In the meantime, if those plants look particularly bad and the rest look good, I'd get those particular plants out of there.
Yeah, pull out the bad ones.
Just yank them.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. Richard, thanks. Maybe pull one of those bad ones and bring it over to the Master Gardeners, and they could see it. They could probably, you know,
that's great.
Even better. Yeah.
Yep.
Richard, thanks for the call.
Yep.
Good luck. Thanks. All right. Nicole from Vineyard Haven says, what do you find best way to prevent and treat downy mildew on dahlias? I already see some white spots on the top of some of my plant leaves.
I would make sure, you know, downy mildew, I've mentioned earlier that wet foliage is beautiful for fungal disorders. In the case of downy mildew, it's not necessarily wet foliage, but high humidity. Mm-hmm. And with all this moisture in the air, even when we don't have actual rain, we have had some humid days. I would probably pick off the worst leaves, and I would go to my local garden center and look to see what sort of material it would be appropriate to treat for downy mildew, and then do that.
Yeah. You remember me saying I didn't experiment, and I put my dahlias in the ground earlier than usual. I think it was almost the end of April, and they are all doing fantastic, except for two. Only two did not come up, and I'm wondering if those might be the two that the dog kept digging up. But
I think you might be onto something.
I think that the dog is to blame for at least one of them.
Yep, it's always good. Blame it on the dog.
Blame it on the dog. But I'm like, okay, so this is good. I mean, they're already a couple of feet tall.
How wonderful!
I know. So I'm excited because it takes so long for them to bloom, and I always can't wait for that.
They are the stars of the late summer garden,
sure.
But you have to wait.
Right.
For them to get there.
And
this
year, I really thought about where to plant them. A lot of the years, I plant them kind of all together. And last year, I was looking around. I'm like, there's stuff in front of them. I can't see them as much. And as all the lilies and other things die off, I'm like, okay, there's nothing blooming over here when you get to the end of the summer. So this time, I made space and spread out my dahlias throughout the perennial borders. So I have a little bit of them everywhere.
Oh, they're going to look beautiful.
I know. I can't wait
for
that. Yeah.
Yep.
What else do we need to know about the perennial garden? Anything else we should be thinking of?
Well, I'm in the process of thinking about weeding.
Mm.
The weeds have done very well so far this spring because it's been damp, and I'm looking in certain areas of my garden, and there's one weed that is my bane. It's called clearweed, and it just comes up everywhere and comes up thickly, and if you miss one and it goes to seed, there are gazillion seedlings the next year, which is the situation I'm in. Fortunately, they're easy to pull out. It's strictly a finding time to do it. A good mulch helps. I've got my annuals in all at the front of the border. I've weeded it, and I will need to get a bag of some sort of mulch and put it down in that area. In the rest of the garden and in my two front beds next to the house, I used my leaf shredder this spring, and all the leaves went through the shredder, and I'm using that as mulch in two of the beds. And it's beautiful stuff, and it will degrade and add organic material to my soil, and I didn't have to cart all the leaves off into the woods. So,
so smart.
That's a win in my book.
Yeah. My bane is bindweed.
Oh yes.
And it started out in such a small section of my yard, and now it's just about everywhere. It's just terrible.
The other one problem I have, fortunately, it's confined to just one section, is creeping buttercup. And sometimes you see weeds and they have such a pretty little flower and you say, oh, isn't that nice? Maybe I'll leave it. And then the next year there's a little bit more of it. And then the following year, it's taken over half that section of your yard.
Right.
So between the creeping buttercup and the little blue forget-me-nots, my God, they take over. It's colorful, but
Lily of the Valley, don't do it.
Yeah, so I'm about to take a weed whacker.
If you could just pull them out easily, it wouldn't be so bad. But boy, those suckers are hard to get out too. And it's just they go everywhere.
Lily of the Valley, for me, someone gave me some beautiful pink Lily of the Valley. And I thank her for that always because they're beautiful and they smell lovely. But now it's like one whole bed is solid Lily of the Valley. So I've planted shrubs in there and eventually they're getting shaded. And last year after they bloomed, I took a weed whacker to it. It's all back and I'm going to, sometime maybe Thursday or Saturday, take a weed whacker to it again. Maybe Saturday because you know what? They say it's not going to rain this Saturday.
Yay, finally,
the first
right?
time since March 15th.
Oh, my goodness, I know. Carol in Falmouth says, for rabbit repellent, she says, I have found that spreading blood meal around the base of a plant has been very effective this year, and it certainly smells better than plant skid or fish fertilizer.
Kudos to her. Yes, a blood meal is, and it also provides nitrogen for your plants.
Yeah.
So yes, that is not that plant skid is inexpensive, but blood meal tends to be a bit pricey.
Yeah. So I was thinking about my iris this year, and you know, last year it seemed like I enjoyed it for so much longer. This year it's like, I'm like, wait, the iris is already come and gone. You know, they're gone.
It was fleeting. And I think mine, I have one named Batik, and it's a beautiful blue, and it looks batiked. It's absolutely gorgeous, and it was looking really lovely, and then we had several days of fairly drizzly wet weather, and those blossoms just sort of melt away.
Yeah, I think that's what happened, yeah.
Yeah, so I cut off all the ones that looked less than appealing, and I got a few more sporadic blooms, but that iris season is over. Now we're into Siberian iris,
yeah,
which
exactly.
seemed to be tougher.
Yeah, I was good. And then, you know, and the dog helped pick a few as well, so that that's what happened with that.
Our gardening partners.
I know, exactly. So it's a good time, you know, with each season I try to take some photos of the beds to remind myself of what's planted where. But it is a good time to sort of, I'm looking around and to an area I didn't get to last year going, you see, I meant to move those astilbes, and now, like, things are growing. I can't see the peony behind all this stuff. So you can see, like, all right, we need to do some thinning here. But I'm not going to get to it right now. So if I take a photo and then I go, wait, what was it I wanted to move, and what did I want to put in there? It's also helpful, too, when, you know, we have no more room, but we can't help it. We'll still buy plants, or we'll still take plants from friends. And we're like, where am I going to put this? And I always end up putting it somewhere that went, that was not the right spot, right? So if you have the photos, you can say, oh, wait a minute, you know, this other plant's going to come up right there, so I better not plant it next to it.
Right. I'm constantly out with my camera.
Your
it's
phone.
My phone.
Yeah.
You know, I remember when I first started photography way back in the 70s, you know, I had the old Minolta, you know, with film and all that sort of good stuff, and then gradually moved up to better cameras, and then gradually moved to digital and have all these lenses and equipment, and guess what? All I ever use now is my phone.
Right.
It's just convenient, and you can delete it if it's no good.
Right. What I also like to, besides being helpful for planning, in the wintertime, you know, when it's snowy out there and you're just looking at, you know, not too much happening, you can go back and look at your pictures and sort of relive your summer garden moments.
Well, it's I used to also sort of keep a little journal, and I don't do that anymore, but I do have a record of what's in bloom, and since the photos on my phone are dated, I know when it was in bloom, and I'm taking pictures from when my Gelina witch hazel blooms in January through, you know, November, when my perennial chrysanthemums bloom. So I have a photographic record that includes the date of when things are in bloom, and it sort of keeps me knowing what to expect in the coming weeks.
Yeah. It's funny, I do the same thing. It's not really a journal, it's a notebook, and when I do my planting, I write down, you know, what, like with the dahlias, I've written down what each one is, you know, and when I planted them. Same thing in my vegetable gardens,
yeah.
When I throw the seeds and, you know, the date. And I find that helpful. Now, I usually, you know, put some of the, you know, like the spinach and seed peas in that at St. Patrick's Day. But sometimes I don't get to it. And it's kind of interesting to look from year to year at when you planted something and, you know, what happened to it.
It
just gives you a nice record. And wait, what were the dahlias I had last year?
But it's not too late to use seeds.
Right.
I have people coming into the garden center saying, well, is it too late? You don't have any lettuce. What can I do? Buy a pack of seed.
Yep, absolutely.
Not
you can
too
still,
late.
Lots of stuff you can still throw in the garden.
Yes.
Horticulturist and entomologist Roberta Clark joins us the third Tuesday of the month through the gardening season. As always, thank you, Roberta.
My pleasure, Mindy.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Burdery and William Coulter.